The power of having a world of information at our fingertips can be dizzying. With the help of search engines like Google, research that would have taken hours can be accomplished in minutes. But what's the price? Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is wondering, is Google making us stupid? That's the title of his recent article that ran in the July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Nicholas Carr is one of our guests this hour. He's the author of the book, The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. We're also joined this hour by Marianne Wolfe, director of the Center for Reading and Language at Tufts University. An open door for you today as well. I hope you'll call up with your take on the question, is Google making us stupid? Have you noticed it's hard for you to focus on longer books or articles that require deep reading and concentration? Or is the efficiency of the internet going to usher in maybe a new era of democratic knowledge? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Nicholas Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
And Marianne Wolfe, welcome to you as well.
Of course, thank you.
And Nicholas Carr, tell me, when did you first notice that things were different when you sat down to maybe read a long book?
I think I've been vaguely aware of it for a few years now, but I noticed that it seemed to be getting worse rather than better. And really, within the last year, I began to make the connection between what I was, the struggles I had in immersing myself in a book or any other kind of act of deep thinking, and my increasing use of the internet. Because what I noticed was that the mental feeling I had when I would sit down and try to concentrate was the same feeling that I had when I was on the net, wanting to, looking for distraction, wanting to click from link to link, and getting antsy when I had to concentrate for a long period of time.
What about you, Marianne Wolfe? Have you seen an upsurge in what Nicholas is talking about?
Well, indeed, the book that I just finished writing began 8 years ago, and when I began it, I had a completely different approach to what I was reading, and over the time, and all this was about reading, and by the end, I found myself almost a victim of the same thing that I was worried about in others. I was information quickly, efficiently, and really not even giving myself the time to reflect about what I was hoping to write about. So it was a sort of a world inside of a world, looking at myself inside the process that I was trying to describe.
And Nicholas, you start your article with some anecdotes about people who report the same things. What are people saying?
Well, you know, when I began to notice this in myself and began to make at least a hypothetical connection with internet use, at about the same time, which is over the course of the past year, I started seeing quite a few other people describing very similar symptoms, often bloggers or other people online. And I began asking, you know, acquaintances and friends, and not all of them, but a significant number, you know, said, gee, that sounds exactly like what's happening to me. And so what they're saying is that they're just having trouble maintaining their concentration, particularly when they sit down with a book or a long article. Their mind starts to drift. They want to rush off and check their email. It's just becoming more and more difficult for them to sustain kind of a long train of thought. And for some of them, it's they simply have given up on what we might call, what Marianne Wolfe refers to as deep reading, reading long things. They just skim everything now.
Is there shown to be a correspondence between what you're talking about and the sales of books, of novels, that kind of thing?
I'm not really sure. I mean, we know that for a long time now, the readership of what we call serious literature has been declining, and for many reasons. And I think the net is one of them, but television and other things. But I don't know. You know, I haven't looked at whether there's a particular connection between sales of types of books and internet use.
What is it about the way that we surf the net? Is it that we just can click from one screen to another, follow links, that it's sort of turning us into a nation of people who just really can't concentrate? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the hypothesis, the thesis is that we know, for one thing, we know that the human brain is malleable, that it adapt and adapt fairly quickly to new stimuli, to new media, and actually at, you know, at a very deep biological level in the actual circuitry of the brain. And we can hypothesize that as the internet becomes more and more our kind of universal medium for gathering information and for entertainment, that it begins to influence the actual structure of our minds. And we begin to adapt to, you know, the ability to leap from piece of information to piece of information through hyperlinking and not and kind of constantly leave what we had been starting to concentrate on in order to read something else. And also, along with that, is that as more and more media, whether it's television or radio or books or anything, turn into internet media, make the move online, they're surrounded, we're surrounded when we're online by all sorts of distractions, by everything else that's going on our computer, by email popping up, instant messages coming in, feed readers telling us some new headline has emerged. So we're learning, we're relearning, I think, how to read in a very different way, not through sustained concentration, but by jumping around and by being kind of constantly distracted.
What do you think, Marianne? Are you seeing that,
Veronica,
in the way the brain is changing?
That I think that's the perfect segue into what cognitive neurosciences are telling us about what the reading brain is and how it's learned. And I'd like to say just two points. The first is to give some supportive data to what Nick just said. When you think about what the brain does when it reads, it's actually having to form a whole new circuit. We were never genetically programmed to read. Reading is an invention of human beings. But it's also reflecting one of the greatest aspects of the human brain, which is our ability to take old structures like vision and language and rearrange them and make a whole new circuit for something new as a function. Now, that's an extraordinary capacity we have, but the downside, or the other side of that is that there is no one circuit for reading. We can look at different languages and see that there's a Chinese circuit for reading, there's a Hebrew circuit, there's an English alphabet circuit. And that also means that when children learn to read, they're different from the adult brain. They are learning to form and fashion, through our explicit teaching, by and large, how to form this comprehending reading brain. That also means that they don't have any one model that genetically they are going to reach. They are going to reach different kinds of circuits. And my real worry about all of this is not a binary worry, but a developmental worry. It's, in other words, it's not are we going to be literate readers, are we going to be digital readers, but how do we form a reading brain that has in its formation all of the stops we have on our present circuit. And those precious milliseconds that our reading brain, yours, Veronica, mine, Nick, our listeners, all of us have this circuit that is set to comprehend, to infer, to have insight, to be critical and analytical, because that's how we were formed. That was the process of our formation. Well, children who are really exposed over and over, are they going to develop a circuit that actually short circuits those deeper processes of inference and critical analysis? And will they be so inured to immediate access that they'll have neither the motivation nor literally the time, because of the medium itself, to go below the surface, to go below the text? They seem to have everything on the surface for themselves.
Why would we lose the ability to be critical thinkers and deep thinkers because we read differently? Can you lay that out a little bit?
Well, if you think about what reading does, let's just take an analogy of a tour bus in a city. That tour bus can make all the stops and you have one version of that city. But what if it doesn't make the last stops of the tour? You're going to lose a lot of what you might have known about that city. The reading circuit is somewhat like that, and the last stops are the deepest part of the process. You get so automatic in the first parts of the circuit that you have the capacity to go beyond and connect all the previous knowledge you have yourself with what you are reading and then go beyond it. When you have a medium that's emphasizing, and this is a concern, not knowledge, Veronica, this is really important, where our evidence stops is right here. We do not have the best evidence yet. We have to, in fact, one of my whole hopes in this discourse is to push for really good research that we can literally image children and adults as they are reading and see whether our concerns, Nick's personal observations, his friend's personal observations, is actually verified by our data of what the brain is doing. Certainly, we have all kinds of anecdotal evidence to that end, including the NEA's, the National Endowment for Arts, recent report to read or not to read, when they're really looking at the decline of comprehension skills in our high schoolers, and of course the lack of reading books by these same kids.
And Nick Carr, you talk about in your article, you have an anecdote about Nietzsche and how he was changed when he started using a typewriter. Can you tell us about that and what you think it illustrates?
Sure. Nietzsche, the philosopher, had severe eye trouble as an adult, as he got older, and he found it increasingly physically difficult to write. It created headaches for him to focus on a page. And fortunately for him, the typewriter was invented, and he bought one, and he was able to learn to touch type, so he could keep his eyes closed, and he could go back to writing. But a friend, there's some interesting correspondence between him and a friend, and the friend points out that his style of writing and even his style of thinking seemed to change when he used this new technology in place of paper and pen. And Nietzsche wrote back that yes, he noticed that too, and said that our tools, the tools we use to write or to read, also influence our thoughts. And I think I use that in the essay to get across the point, and it's a point made by many people, made famous by Marshall McLuhan in the 60s, that the media we use, the technologies and tools we use to gather information, to read, to otherwise process knowledge and to use our intellect, influence the way we think. The way, cognitive patterns, memory, and even our conception of ourselves, I think, and of our place in the world. And that's one of the, one of the main themes of my article, that this, what the internet seems to be doing to us in influencing our way of thinking is nothing new. It happens, I believe, over and over again through human history. And you could even argue that the ability to read deeply, at least at a broad level of society, really only emerged 500 years ago with the invention of another technology, the printing press. So these changes, I think, are nothing new. And even though, as Marianne pointed out, we don't yet have hard scientific proof that this is going on today, we have a lot of evidence that it's gone on in the past, and I think we should be concerned, if not worried, that it's going on again.